KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Extreme weather, climate change, and pollution are weakening the global economy. Tonight, Amy Larkin discusses how the natural world and business can coexist. Larkin is the former solutions director of Greenpeace and the author of Environmental Debt: The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Larkin spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 1st, 2013.
So I'm going to talk tonight about the rules of business and the laws of nature, which are in collision. And our job is to bring them into cohesion. We all know about the two sides of the financial ledger, profit and loss. But there's another way to look at the financial ledger, and that's cause and effect. Every financial transaction has an environmental impact, and the environment is embedded in every financial transaction. Every transaction. The financial and environmental crises are connected in causes and solutions. So here's an example. Do you all remember the floods in Thailand in 2011? Yes. They were devastating, and they were caused by a huge flood, a huge typhoon, which may or may not have been exacerbated by climate change. Don't know. But they became a catastrophe because of deforestation. So 20 years before, in Thailand, through huge logging and deforestation, the mountainsides were taken away, the topsoil was eroded. There was no land left 20 years later to hold the water. And thus, Thailand became a disaster area. So what happened from that? Well, it was terrible for the people of Thailand, but Toyota and Honda have factories there. And so they didn't have parts. And so what happened? Tens of thousands of workers in Kentucky, Singapore, and the Philippines lost their jobs. And the diner down the road from the factory lost their jobs. And we as taxpayers paid unemployment insurance, et cetera, et cetera. You can see how these transactions connect to one another. But in my mind, the most basic rule of business is this: no nature, no business. And I think I'm going to read from you from just a few pages from the beginning of my book. That's a very good time for that phone to go off. And I think it's going to hopefully show you why I'm optimistic, which is amazing. In October 2010, in a dull hotel ballroom in suburban Chicago, a rare combination of individual conviction, corporate fortitude, and strange bedfellows moved a group of executives to transform refrigeration in their industry. The leadership of the Consumer Goods Forum, CGF, a group of 400 of the world's biggest retailers and consumer goods manufacturers, knew that better refrigeration could achieve a 2% decrease in the world's greenhouse gas emissions, an amount comparable to global air travel. So there I was, the keynote speaker at the first CGF Sustainable Refrigeration Summit. As then Solutions Director of Greenpeace, I challenged the group to eliminate an exceptionally potent greenhouse gas, HFCs, from all cooling technologies by 2015. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Unilever had been working with Greenpeace for many years to achieve this transition. This was the day we asked the entire consumer goods sector to make the same move, and we were all notably nervous. Many doubted that a 2015 deadline was attainable. Fortunately, there was also a palpable feeling in the room that we could find a way to do something extraordinary together. And then at 4 p.m., nearing the end of the day, the meeting leader asked the vice president from a multinational retailer, "You'll do this, right?" The VP's face, literally, it lost all color while he imagined what it would take to achieve this audacious goal. But before responding, he looked at his biggest competitor and asked, "You're going to do this?" She nodded her head, and then the first VP, still looking shocked, answered, "Yes, we'll support this resolution." I figured that board approval would take about 6 months. This was a very radical step, and the board members were the chief executives of 50 of the world's largest corporations. Nope. Mukhtar Kent, the co-chair of the CGF and CEO of Coca-Cola, wanted to announce the resolution at the United Nations climate talks in Cancun exactly 1 month later. And he did. There is a change in the weather, and not just from climate change. The environmental news has become so consistently terrible that its effects on business are now undeniable, unpredictable, and damned expensive. In multinational boardrooms and executive suites across the world, attitudes towards environmental needs and responsibilities are changing as environmental problems start to derail corporate success, even survival. Such shifts directly conflict with every corporation's strong imperative to cut costs in the short term. If a company invests heavily in dramatic changes that will secure its environmental and fiscal future, it is likely to endure some lousy quarterly earnings. And this is because today's rules and regulations encourage businesses to separate long and short-term choices. Investing in new green technology and systems costs a lot on the front end, and the resulting savings might not materialize for many years. But for the moment, stock market pressures and job security usually collude firmly on the side of quarterly earnings. But logically, if today's actions cause grave environmental consequences in the future, then they should not be logged as quarterly profits. Not now, not ever. In fact, they should instead be logged as environmental debt. So there is, in fact, I think as you can tell, a growing interest from many corporations on this symbiosis between nature and business. And I think, do you guys remember in 2009 when there was a cap and trade bill in the US Congress when there actually is a thought maybe something like that could happen? And something very odd and encouraging happened. The US Chamber of Commerce did what it always does, can't do this and it's environmental law, it's gonna cost money, it's gonna hurt the economy, it's gonna hurt jobs, cannot do it, cannot do it. Well, what happened? Well, a bunch of big, iconic American companies either left the Chamber of Commerce, quit the board of the Chamber of Commerce, publicly said, hell no, you are not talking for us. And you can see, these are big companies. Levi's, Nike, Johnson & Johnson, Exelon, the largest utility in the country, Apple, and against the guys on the other side who are the fossil fuel companies who are, we hope, running out of their headline position. Let's just call it that. But this is part of why I'm optimistic. So then there are companies that are going further. Puma, the sportswear company, created something called an environmental profit and loss statement. So why is this important? They announced to the world that their environmental impact was about $193 million a year. And who measured this for them? PricewaterhouseCoopers and Trucost, a much smaller company. But as you all know, PricewaterhouseCoopers is one of the largest financial service firms in the world. And Puma said to the world, we are causing $193 million of environmental degradation. And we are aware that if we had to pay it, it would take 72% of our profit away. So that the biggest polluter would make the biggest profit. That is the problem with the financial and environmental regulations not being in cohesion. So I'll give you another story that is comparable to this. I was talking with head of sustainability for Pepsi, where an engineer was a conservative Republican Texas engineer telling me how proud he was that the breakthrough technology at their new factory where they had a new PepsiCo owns Frito-Lay, and in the new Frito-Lay factory, it was near net zero energy, waste, and water. Remarkable engineering achievements. And so he was very excited about them, and I said, so does this mean that you're going to now deploy this everywhere in the world? I presume you are, because this is how we're going to save the world. And he said, well, you know, it's actually much more expensive to do it this way. And so we can't deploy all of it because, right, pained faces everywhere, because their short-term profits will look bad. They will save money. They will save energy. They will save waste. They will save water. They will look great in 5 years. But next quarter, they will be killed by Wall Street. And their senior management will be very often either fired or punished or put on notice. So this is the rules that need to change. And so Puma stepping forward, what happened with that? Of course, a lot of people attack their methodology, and they've actually said we could do much better. And so instead of backtracking from it, what are they doing? They're moving forward. They're doing an improved lessons learned environmental profit and loss, and their parent company, PPR, which owns Yves Saint Laurent and Gucci and Stella McCartney and a lot of luxury brands, they're doing it across the whole company. And many other businesses, multinational corporations, are also moving forward to create environmental profit and loss statements. So what's the other powerhouse financial service firms doing? Well, KPMG is probably Pricewaterhouse's biggest competitor. They put out a report about a year ago that said in 2008 the 3,000 largest public companies were estimated to be causing $2.15 trillion of environmental damage. That is real money paid by real people, real taxpayers, real families, real other businesses. It is amazing, though, that KPMG did a report like this, because that's antagonizing most of their clients. The same way Pricewaterhouse did that report for Puma. What does that say to all their clients? The accountants are stepping up. It's a big change. This is one of the huge reasons why I am actually optimistic. And China, maybe a month ago, put out a report stating that 3.5% of its GDP was caused by environmental damage. So first of all, if they said it was 3.5%, what do you think it really was? Yeah. Guesses? 3.5% it was not. But the point is, that 3.5% is the cost so that we can buy our cheap computers, we can buy our cheap clothing. 25% of China's exports come to the United States. So these are the laws of nature and the rules of business that have to come together. I think also, as you can see, there's a trend in what I'm talking about. As these connections are becoming crystal clear, after Hurricane Sandy, what was the message of the largest business research firm in the world, which is Bloomberg? That was their message, in case you missed it. And so Sandy is probably going to cost $100 billion plus dollars, and maybe more. My mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, just proposed $20 billion to build a seawall set of levees around New York City, which I'm sure will be tremendously effective against the rising tides. So I think that it's going to bring us to the definition of environmental debt. Polluting and or damaging actions that will cost other parties, people, businesses, or governments real money in the future. We cannot separate our financial and environmental systems. They are no more separate than mind and body. They are the same system. So business is, because of globalization, business is actually feeling these effects differently. So when the Mayans depleted their water resources, if you were in China or Europe, honestly, you didn't care. You didn't know, and it didn't affect you. Now, if there is a flood in Pakistan or a heat wave in the Ukraine where 10% of the world's cotton or 10% of the world's wheat is destroyed, if you are a person in Egypt and your price of wheat goes up, well, you might have an uprising, for better or for worse. And if you are a corporation, you might have, and you produce pizza or pajamas, you might not be able to predict your profit and loss because your costs are unpredictable and your availability is unpredictable. I can't get the cotton. I can't get the wheat. So I think that this brings me back to my heroes, as I've mentioned before, which are the accountants. And those of you who know me know that's an odd thing that someone like me would be enamored of accountants these days. But I think that these are the people who are going to help us measure what we need to measure so that we can change the rules as we need to change them. And in my book, there are dozens of organizations that of accountants and show what is being done. And I will give you information later on how you can find out. These are the people to watch, guys. These are the people to watch. I guess, as I said before, these are the people who also understand that all money is not created equal. Chemotherapy is not really good for the GDP. It's not good for anybody. You know, it may heal you if you're super lucky or you. It may heal you, but it will clearly be not a desired part of GDP.
Amy Larkin, the author of Environmental Debt: The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Larkin is the former solutions director of Greenpeace, and she currently heads a consulting firm called Nature Means Business. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 1st, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Amy Larkin in a moment. 824, 94.9 KUOW. Youth leader Tajay Gaynor has devoted his energies to conflict resolution and school mediation activities after he witnessed the stabbing of a friend. Hear him talk about educating urban youth about the alternatives to violence, about why street life can be transcended, and about how we're all responsible for creating bonds of tranquility in a world that often thrives on calamity. That's tonight at 10:30. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight: mostly clear, lows in the 50s. Friday, sunny skies, highs 70s to mid-80s. Friday night, clear, lows in the 50s. And Saturday, sunny skies, highs near 80 degrees. The lawyer for Vladimir Putin's first prominent political prisoner reflects on today's high-profile jailing of Russian opposition activist Alexei Navalny. Also, for months, police have been searching for seven masterpieces stolen from a museum in Rotterdam. Turns out the thief's mother probably cooked them up in her oven. We'll get an explanation. Both those items tonight at 11 o'clock.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend. The 2013 lineup includes local band Death Cab for Cutie, playing transatlanticism, heart, and more. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Amy Larkin has been fighting for the environment for years. She's the former solutions director of Greenpeace, and she currently heads a consulting firm called Nature Means Business. Her new book is called Environmental Debt: The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Environmental debt refers to events such as global warming, extreme weather, and pollution. Larkin spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 1st, 2013. Next, she talks about some of her personal environmental heroes.
And I'm going to move along to people who are closer to my heroes. Yeah. And I think you can read it as it is, but I guess, does anybody have a good imitation of Spock here? To hunt a species to extinction is not logical. Ironic, when man was killing these creatures, he was destroying his own future. Well, I think that if today's actions cause grave damage, we will not survive. We know this now. We are aware that our civilization is at a precipice. And so I think that an example of what we have to reach for is, in fact, why we love Star Trek so much. And that is because it is the greatest ambition always throughout and the greatest humility. And unless we combine ambition with humility, we're never going to do what we need to do. And I think that the humility towards nature is something that is not in our culture, in our lifestyle, nor in our rules of business. So I think that a good reminder is King Midas. As you all, I'm sure, remember, King Midas wanted only one thing. His ambition was for one thing only, and that was gold. He was granted his wish, and everything turned to gold, including his beloved daughter. Does anybody here know what he died of? Hunger. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly, guys. And I think that that is why we have to change these rules. These are the current rules of business. Pollution is largely free to the polluter, which is why Pepsi and Puma cannot do what they want to do, because the biggest polluter will make the biggest profit. And the world is such that if you are in business, and your competitor is making 72% more than you are because they're doing a bad job of protecting the environment, your business landscape doesn't work for you. Second rule of business today: earnings statements do not include long-term financial, environmental, and social impacts. So what should those logs have cost in Thailand? Well, I don't really know, but I guarantee you it did not cost the devastation that was caused by... It did not cost 3.5% of Toyota's output. That's for sure. And governments subsidize business with no concern for environmental impact. So most of you probably know about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which is largely caused by agricultural runoff and agricultural waste. So it's pesticides and manure. And in fact, both of those businesses are hugely subsidized by our government. And so the government is subsidizing the industry that's causing the problem. They're subsidizing the fishing industries that are going out of business. They're subsidizing the diners that are going out of business. They're subsidizing the health care for the people who are getting sick from the dead zone. They're subsidizing the educational system. That's us subsidizing it. I don't want to subsidize that anymore, and I'm sure you don't either. Am I right? Yeah. I speak for you, I think, on that. So I, in my book, suggest a new framework, which I call the Nature Means Business Framework. And it's pretty straightforward. Pollution can no longer be free. The long view must guide all decision-making. And government plays a vital role in catalyzing clean technology and growth while preventing environmental destruction. The internet didn't happen just because there were some cool guys in garages in Silicon Valley. It happened because the United States government stepped in at varying times and supported those cool guys in the garages. And then it invented, designed, deployed in one big bit of money and R&D, the internet. And then in 1991, Al Gore, then senator from Tennessee, stepped forward and, in fact, put a huge amount of money to R&D and infrastructure to ramp up the internet in the United States. So government, and that unleashed trillions of dollars of profits, business, an entire new way of the world. So government plays a vital role, and we can never forget that. So I think that, what does it say here? So how do we change course? Well, it's not easy. This is not something that's going to happen by, you know, incremental changes. This is more like a revolution. This is more like a forest fire that then creates a regeneration. So I have teamed up with an organization called Resolve that specializes in arbitration and negotiation. And we are going to bring together stakeholders from across the spectrum to try to create a transition agenda. And there are two questions we're going to basically address. And they are, if fossil fuels and pollution cost their true prices based on new financial rules, how will that melt down the economy? So if gas, which is really supposed to cost about $10, $11 a gallon, that's really going to kill a lot of people. It will be hugely painful. It will melt down the economy. It will harm poor people. It will devastate poor people, especially people who do not live near public transit. But if dirty energy and consumption continue to be underpriced, how will that melt down the environment? Well, I think we know how it will melt down the environment because it's already melting it down. And so the kinds of solutions that we hope to put together at a transition agenda, which we will in, it will be live in about a week, we are inviting people. We're not going to reinvent the wheel. We are inviting people to learn what other people are doing. We are inviting people to work with one another. We're going to use crowdsourcing to bring forth new ideas. We're connect people from one end of the spectrum with the other. It is a way to answer these questions together. People from both sides of the spectrum try to answer these questions separately. You can't. So that is what we're going to try to do in a transition agenda. And we will use new rules to encourage and incentivize radical approaches that incorporate nature and the survival of nature in anything that we propose. And there will be a lot of businesses at the table with us. And as you saw, there are a lot of businesses ready to engage. Business is much more courageous than government in stepping forward. And you, many of you also know, I never thought I would say that. But there are businesses ready to engage because they're aware that their survival is at stake. They cannot predict anything because of environmental problems. And so basically I just want to end with saying our work is to connect environmental and financial solutions so that the laws of nature meet the rules of business. Thank you. So does anybody have any questions? Karen?
So there's two things. I hear that actually the insurance industry is really getting involved in global climate change and really making us aware of the uncertainty of the climate change and the damage that's going to happen. So insurance industry, the other one is the Pentagon, I understand also that they feel that, global climate change is a national security issue, and they're making plans to try to be less polluting. Of course, the military-industrial complex is very polluting, but do you have any comments on either of those?
Yes, and actually, I'm repeating the question because KOW is recording this.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
So Karen asked first about the insurance industry and second about the Pentagon and defense spending and their interests and work on climate change in particular. And yes, in fact, the insurance industry, and that's actually in the book, is been killed by extreme weather. And in fact, I have in the book Munich Ray charts on the costs of extreme weather, and they're off the hook, and they will continue. They're only continue to skyrocket, and they are, in the United States, they are much less active than they are in Europe, though. And however, behind the scenes, when I was working for Greenpeace, I was introduced to a Harvard professor working on a coal report that was fairly radical, akin to a report that we were working on at Greenpeace. And in fact, this was from a very an insurance CEO in the United States. And I think the Pentagon, one of the things that drove me crazy last year was that in Afghanistan, the Pentagon was using what I think is the best possible solution for vehicle fuel, which was waste to fuel. So it closed the loop on a whole bunch of problems, but it's very expensive. And it's especially expensive now because there is very little R&D in it. It is not being incentivized because the government is not stepping up to incentivize it. And so what happens? A bunch of people in Congress attack the Department of Defense. Why are you using, you know, spending $27 a gallon for waste to energy fuel when you can get it cheap? You can't get it as cheap as you can here because it has to be transported, etc. But the point is because the military feels that they need energy that they can create in a distributed fashion. So obviously, the military has a huge carbon pollution social footprint, but in fact, huge amounts of fantastic R&D, the best R&D, in fact, on renewable energy is largely coming from the U.S. military.
Amy Larkin, the author of Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Larkin is the former solutions director of Greenpeace, and she currently heads a consulting firm called Nature Means Business. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 1st, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Amy Larkin in a moment, 840-949-KUOW. A Manitoba rancher who used to have 2,000 bison on his land talks about counting them recently and finding far fewer than that. Also, in a remote village in northern Australia, a new language has come into being. A conversation about it with the linguist who discovered it. Both those items tonight in the 11 o'clock hour. President Obama has replaced two nominees to the National Labor Relations Board in a concession to Republican senators. Later this evening, a conversation about politics, policymaking, and the NLRB. That's tonight at midnight. Mostly clear tonight, says the forecast for the Seattle area. Lows in the 50s. For Friday, sunny skies, highs 70s to mid-80s. Friday night, clear skies, lows in the 50s. Saturday, sunny skies, highs near 80 degrees. The Mandela Tapes, coming up in a few minutes. It's a special from the CBC radio series Ideas. The program draws on 50 hours of recorded conversations with Nelson Mandela. Along with his voice, you'll hear those of reporter Rick Stengel, who recorded Mandela between 1992 and 1996 while working for Rolling Stone, and freelance radio producer Robin Benger. It's in a few minutes. Actually, it's right after the 9 o'clock news.
KUOW thanks the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Amy Larkin is the former Solutions Director of Greenpeace. Now she heads the consulting firm Nature Means Business. Her new book is called Environmental Debt: The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 1st, 2013. Next, she takes questions from the audience. The first question is about the difference between the actual cost and the external cost of gasoline.
But the external costs are the key. And this is what the accounting firms and Puma and other companies are talking about. We are ready to discuss the external costs. That is a revolution.
And they are also using other alternative fuels also.
Yes.
I'm wondering, I know you're not based in Seattle anymore, but do you know of any Seattle business leaders that are looking at long-term planning or concerned about climate impacts on their business?
Well, I'm pretty sure that Amazon is looking at renewable energy for its databases, and I know that Microsoft has taken a step, which is that they are basically charging themselves a carbon fee for their carbon, but they are not changing their sourcing. They're just setting money aside, which is better than not doing that, whereas Google, Facebook, and I think Apple soon are going actually to be developing renewable energy projects. I'm sure Microsoft will do that soon. And I don't know about other Seattle companies.
How about this local issue of providing a way to drive cheap coal across the ocean to China coming out of...
So the question is about cheap coal being exported out of Seattle to China. Not a very good idea. And I can tell you, not only is it not a good idea environmentally, which obviously it stinks from top to bottom environmentally, but in terms of business, you know, Rajan Tata, the biggest industrialist in India, talks about his fear that his coal assets are going to be stranded assets. I think that it is clear that coal is on its way out. How fast, we don't know, but the signs are all over from in the United States to even in China, where it is obviously a huge piece of their environmental footprint, but their environmental, when they announce that 3.5% of their GDP is from environmental degradation, they are getting ready to make big changes, and they're not going to do it slowly. They don't do nothing slowly. So I think that obviously it's a bad idea environmentally, but I think financially and economically it's a horrible idea. So that's what I think.
Going back to your earlier example where you were at Greenpeace, you were at that meeting and one corporate CEO turned to the other and said, "Are you going to do it?" "Yes, yes." And then they came on board. Is this the general mentality of the big corporations, that it's really driven by what their competitors are doing, so it's sort of the Jones.
So the question is about, is our businesses functioning with looking at what their competitors are doing? I mean, I think that we're all here old enough to know that everything is high school. And so I think, obviously, yes, the answer is of course they look at what their competitors are. Of course they look at what their competitors are doing. On every level, what their, you know, Puma decided they're not going to go with shoeboxes anymore. They're going to use bags from recycled materials, which will save a huge amount of money on freight, which will put a bunch of shoebox manufacturers out of business. Of course, everybody's going to follow them. I mean, shoeboxes are the dumbest thing in the world. But, you know, that's a little example. But it's going to happen as an industry changes. It changes very rapidly once the leadership corporations make a change.
And my follow-up question is, which sectors? You mentioned textiles with Puma, mm-hmm. Coca-Cola. You also mentioned, is that the case that the textile industry and the food and beverage industry are sort of the leaders in this change?
I think the question is, which industries are the leaders? And in every industry, I mean, Google, honestly, in renewable energy is absolutely the leader. So guess what? What did Facebook do? It hired away from Google their green energy czar. So what did Apple do? It hired the former EPA director, Lisa Jackson, who is very front and forward environmentally, to be their green energy czar. So you think they're competing? They're competing. They're competing in a way you want them to compete. And I think that I would say that in the oil industry, I've been in a lot of meetings with senior management of big oil companies, and they will all say we disagree. But I was actually in a meeting, I won't talk about it, never mind. Jack.
I'm curious if you, how do the accountants, the new heroes,
right?
How do they have a conversation with organizations like ALEC? Or the grand wizard, Jim DeMint, and the Heritage Foundation? How do the accountants open a conversation with them and convince those?
Well, first of all, the question is about how do the accountants deal with organizations like ALEC, so, or Heartland, or other organizations like that. Well, obviously, those organizations are, I think, the only people that could ever talk to them are people on their side. I mean, the interesting thing is the number of companies. Just as companies left the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, I think there's 25 companies that left ALEC in the last, something like that, in the last year. And I'm happy to say I was involved in a bunch of meetings where to help that along. But I think that the accountants, for me, I don't know the answer to your question. It's the real answer. But I think the fact that KPMG puts out a report, if you read, and I have it in the book, actually, the introduction to that report from KPMG, where they talk about $2.15 trillion of environmental damage from all their clients, you read that introduction, you think, is this from Greenpeace? No, it's from their CEO. That is chutzpah. That is a change. That is that company stating, we want to measure this. The same for Pricewaterhouse. And so, of course, going to your question about the company, guess what? Ernst & Young, of course, has a head of climate change, and Deloitte Touche has a head of climate change and sustainability, and they are all looking to outdo the last thing that the last people did on this, because this world is the train is on the tracks. It does not have the motor it needs now. Until these rules change, nothing is going to change, because Puma said to the world, 72% of our profit should not be ours. But they don't have to do anything with that. But the fact that they stated it said that they want to. And the fact that Price Waterhouse measured it and is going to remeasure it says that we recognize this has to change. That is new and exciting.
I just hoped you could clarify a little bit. The earlier slide where you showed the rift and you showed companies on the right that were clearly doing some new things, and then you had a bunch of energy companies on the left.
Yeah.
The suggestion was that the energy companies were on the other side of the fence. Were these companies selected specifically because they were the bad actors or because they are actually energy companies that are doing some interesting things?
No, these were selected because these were the companies that said to the Chamber of Commerce, you have to go fight this cap and trade legislation. This is the largest oil company, it's the largest coal company.
Okay. So they were specifically fighting the cap and trade legislation.
Yes, absolutely. And they
specifically the energy companies on the left of this slide.
So this is about Exxon, Shell, Peabody, and BP, and the energy companies that were fighting the cap and trade legislation. So, without any doubt, these companies have vested interest. And there's something in the book I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's called The Carbon Bubble. And it shows that of the $22 trillion of assets currently on the books of the global oil companies, if it is burned, if something like 95% of it is burned, it will move the world beyond into catastrophic climate change. So they are holding about $20 trillion on their books of what one could call unburnable assets. Because if they use those assets, we are going into we are in a runaway climate change situation with no return. So this is a case where, they're counting on those $20 trillion. Their investors are counting on that $20 trillion. Their workers are counting on it. The companies that service their workers, the states that get the taxes from it, this is what has to be unraveled, and this is why I think I am working with Resolve to create a transition agenda, because coal's got to go out of business. Does anybody here wish coal miners ill? No. Would I be happy to pay taxes to retrain coal miners to weatherize every building in the United States? I would. It has to be done. And there is no politician who is going to stand up and say that. Even though I also show in the book that in the state of Kentucky, if you measure the real cost of coal, the state of Kentucky loses $115 million a year in revenue from coal. Just no one's counting.
So my father was a partner at Pete Marwick, which became...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm really glad to hear this.
Yeah, Dad.
But coming from that tradition, I have to ask a skeptical question.
Okay.
How much can be accomplished with business, and let's just for the sake of argument say the states working on this, while we have paralysis in Congress? How much can we really do? And what is your actual vision for how that's done?
Well, so the question is, how much can happen while there's paralysis in Congress? Well, the answer I have is that if there is political will, the reason I wrote this book is that currently the policy debate and the business debate does not talk about the real costs. So when I now talk to my congresspeople, I talk about, I don't want to pay. I don't want to pay for global warming. Forget about the environment, the critters, the ocean, who cares? I don't want to pay. I don't want to pay for another Hurricane Sandy. I don't want to pay to rebuild another coastline. I don't want to pay to rebuild Trent Lott's house. I don't want to do it. But I think that the education of the public about you are already paying. You are already paying for the cost of environmental degradation. In New York City in 2006, the majority of time from pediatricians was for three different things. The first one was asthma. You think that's caused by pollution? The second one was development disabilities and autism. So a new study from a week ago that showed that diesel and mercury contribute and cause autism. Third thing is rare childhood cancers. They all have, so what do those things do to the financial state of every state and government? You know, families, businesses, individuals, state taxes, federal taxes, your school system, your healthcare system, your fishing resorts, you are already paying. And I think that there are many reasons why people will rise up with political will. But the only way, in our country at least, when government will get any courage is when businesses give them the cover to have it. So for me, that's why there's room for everybody to do everything. There is so much work to be done. But for me, my work is helping to nudge along those big companies who are actually on the precipice of being extremely courageous and helping them be more courageous than they dreamt they could be.
Amy Larkin, the author of Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Larkin is the former solutions director of Greenpeace, and she currently heads a consulting firm called Nature Means Business. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 1st, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW and the Seattle Gilbert and Sullivan Society present The Gondoliers. In this comic opera, two gondoliers have three wives, leading to confusion about who is married to whom and which of them is king. July 12th through the 27th at the Bagley Wright Theater. More on the events page at kuow.org.
859 KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle. 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Seattle band Candlebox made its debut in 1993 in the golden age of alternative rock in the Northwest. Now, 20 years since their first album release, Candlebox is once again touring and creating new music. Lead singer Kevin Martin explains what it was like to make music in the era of Seattle alternative rock, and how their music has changed over the years when he's our guest tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Today's KUOW Day sponsors are Don, Jeff, and Stephen Coiner, wishing Barbara a happy birthday, and Jeff and Sarah Callender, celebrating 15 happy years of marriage. And support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore, an independent bookseller with 9 locations that offer thousands of new and used titles, Husky gear, and gift items. Learn more about upcoming author events and store locations at ubookstore.com.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.